our guest tonight, as we started, was our new city attorney, David Chu. Yay. And he's going to tell us what the city attorney does. And it's a brand new job for him. So I'm sure I'd like to hear about some of your goals and maybe some of the things you've learned in the first few weeks.
Sure thing. Well, first of all, thank you, Dennis and Frank, for inviting me to get to know your association. And maybe I'll start by saying I've had a chance to get to meet some of you over the years when I was a supervisor representing the Northeast neighborhoods and president of the Board of Supervisors, and also when I was representing the East Side in the state legislature. But two points of kind of personal connection. I got my start as a neighborhood activist, as the chair of Lower Polk Neighbors on Polk Street, and really have always appreciated the leadership of neighborhood volunteers and activists, and have always viewed the work that you do as really helping to direct and guide what those of us in government ought to be focused on. The other thing I'll say is I'm 51 now, but when I was in my late 20s and early 30s, I was dating my then girlfriend, who lived in your part of the city on Irving Street. And so I spent an awful lot of time getting to know the Inner Sunset, and also today my in-laws live in Lakeside, so not far from where you are. So delighted to have a chance to get to know Sharp and learn about the issues that you're focused on. Maybe also by way of background, in a past life, before I became a public official, I worked as a civil rights attorney, as a criminal prosecutor, spent some time working as a constitutional lawyer for the United States Senate. So being able to come back home to San Francisco to work in City Hall as your new city attorney, it's both an honor, but it's also wonderful to get back to the profession that I started off in and spent a lot of my career in, which is in the law. So what I wanted to do, Dennis mentioned that there were already some questions about the difference between the city attorney and the district attorney, and I've noticed just in my first couple of months these perennial questions. So we put together a pretty quick PowerPoint presentation to sort of lay out a little bit of, and I'll ask Michelle on my team, who is my community outreach person, to go to this slide. So I want to talk a moment about who we are, what it is that we do, and how our office can work with Sharp and associations like you to help improve our city. Next slide. So the city attorney was established under the San Francisco City Charter, which is our city's constitution. We have one of 11 elected city attorneys in the state of California. As you could probably imagine, we practice civil law and not criminal law. And I'll talk a little bit more about that distinction in this presentation. But I also mentioned that our office, we represent the city and county of San Francisco, but not necessarily individual members of the public. We bring lawsuits on behalf of the public, but we don't necessarily, say, represent Frank Noto on issues. We represent the city's interest. And there are a number of things we do, from advice and counsel to all city policymakers, to defending the city against lawsuits, to bringing affirmative litigation. And I'll talk more about that in a second. But I think the most important thing for you to know is, unlike the city attorney in a lot of other jurisdictions, we are an independent office. We are accountable to the public through the ballot box. The city attorney, because it's an elected position, it's part of our city's time-tested system of checks and balances. And I will mention, in case folks were wondering, I've been appointed into the role that was vacated by our 20-year city attorney, Dennis Herrera. There's a special election for my seat this coming June, and it's a four-year term, like many elected positions in San Francisco. Next slide. So our office, we have over 300 legal professionals. And as I mentioned, we represent the city and county of San Francisco. Luis Rennie, who was the city attorney before Dennis Herrera, used to refer to the fact that we advise every agency from A to Z, from the airport to the zoo. So if you think of police and fire, public health, human services, rec and park, muni, port, public utilities, water, wastewater, energy, we work with all of these departments. We also are counsel to the mayor and to every member of the Board of Supervisors, as well as many of our city elected officials, like our treasurer, et cetera. Next slide. So talking about some of the categories of work we do, I mentioned that we provide legal counsel to 100 plus city agencies, boards, and commissions. And so our purview, our mission is really to provide consistent, independent, objective, and really the best legal advice that we possibly can. We draft and negotiate and approve as to form every contract the city gets involved in. We also draft and approve as to form every local ordinance that gets proposed. And we provide a lot of written legal advice, some of which is under attorney-client privilege, but many of our written legal memos are public and available on our city website. Next slide. So I mentioned we defend the city against any number of about 4,000 claims brought against the city every year. A claim is brought to us. That is the precursor to a lawsuit filed against San Francisco. We have investigators who look into the claims that are brought. And if we find them to be meritorious, we will often settle early on some of the claims that are brought against the city. And then for others, we defend the city in every legal forum that San Francisco is represented, from administrative hearings to state and federal trial and appellate court, the California Supreme Court. And literally just this morning at 7 a.m., there was a case, Arizona versus San Francisco, in the United States Supreme Court. And I was super proud of the work that our office did to defend San Francisco's position in a lawsuit that was initiated against the Trump administration in the immigration context. And unfortunately, it's an issue that has lingered since Donald Trump lost his election to President Biden. But nonetheless, we are strongly defending, obviously, our city's position. For these 4,000 claims, they really range from everything from, say, everyday slip and falls to muni accidents, labor disputes, tax issues. Anytime someone sues the city for, say, a local law passed by the Board of Supervisors, property damage, etc. Next slide. In addition to what we defend, we also bring affirmative litigation in instances when cities have been harmed. So we're, some of our more notable cases, marriage equality, when we defended City College against a federal accrediting agency, all the lawsuits that I mentioned involving the Trump administration. We can bring lawsuits on behalf of the people of the state of California when our interests are harmed. Typically, we bring these lawsuits under what's known as the unfair competition law on behalf of consumers. And I'll mention at this very moment, we are suing the opioid industry for their harm to San Francisco. We've sued the lead paint industry, gun manufacturers, Recology, et cetera. We also bring lawsuits on behalf of workers. So at this very moment, we're engaged in major litigation with Uber and Lyft. And we also settled the largest settlement in the history of our city's office labor standards enforcement against DoorDash, millions of dollars on behalf of workers. At this moment, we are also engaged in groundbreaking litigation against five of the largest oil companies in the world based on their impact on San Francisco and sea level rise. Why don't we go to the next slide? You may be aware of the fact that in addition to investigators that we have, our office has been deeply involved in public integrity work, most notably around a number of very highly publicized incidents of corruption that our office helped to uncover. We get tips and reports of unethical, unlawful, corrupt behavior within city government. It is our duty and responsibility to carry out those investigations when it comes to wasteful practices, misuse of city funds, improper activities by governmental officials. We work closely with the controller's office through their whistleblower program to make sure that we are fully investigating all instances of corruption. So I know this has been of interest to a lot of San Franciscans, so I want to highlight this work. Next slide. So part of what I want to spend a little bit of time is just letting you know that we do a lot of work to address what are known as public nuisances in San Francisco. Oftentimes, nuisances typically involve violations of a whole variety of state and local rules. So whether it be at the city level, violations of our health code, our building code, fire, housing, planning, plumbing, administrative code, or at the state level, violations of housing laws, health and safety laws, etc. We can bring lawsuits typically against property owners when a property owner is creating a nuisance to your neighborhood. And so I want to give some examples of what we're talking about. If in your neighborhoods you see any of these images, illegal construction, disrepair, neglect of a property, abandoned properties, hoarding and cluttering, if you are aware of continued unauthorized short-term rentals, if you have heard of or have any evidence of fraud related to our affordable housing rules, we can bring lawsuits through our code enforcement team. Illegal nightclubs, vehicle repair shops that are not licensed. And then I think there are two more slides. If there's a liquor store that is creating a nuisance, or if there's a property where there is known drug manufacturing or drug sales, again, we can, as long as we have the evidence to prove it, bring a lawsuit against a property owner for activities that are violating laws in your neighborhoods. And so we want to really kind of emphasize that as we're talking with neighborhood associations. And why don't we go to the last slide? So how is it that we work together? So here are a number of things for folks to consider. One is, you know, obviously, if you're aware of any complaints or issues under any of these categories, feel free to contact our office for general affirmative litigation complaints. Here is our email address. For code enforcement issues, we have a hotline, 554-3977, or I want to mention that for every police district, we have an assigned deputy city attorney, and I want to take a moment and introduce one of our great deputy city attorneys, Britt Strutman, who is assigned to the Terrible Police Station. You can ask her, provide any feedback or information to her about a situation in the neighborhood. I mentioned the controller's whistleblower program, and we put the link there. And then I'll also just reiterate that if there is an emergency, a crime in progress, a medical emergency, a person in distress, call 911. If there are everyday problems, trash, graffiti, potholes, traffic safety issues, etc., you should call 311. But I would say if you see ongoing issues, particularly within the control of someone's property, feel free to call us and we're happy to take a look, potentially send an investigator, think about whether we can bring a lawsuit in this area. So with that, that's sort of hopefully the 7-minute introduction to our office, and happy to answer any questions.
Hi, David.
Great.
Go ahead,
Wesley. Yep.
Okay.
Ask your question.
Hi, David. This is Wesley Deer. I'm on the board of SHARP. You look good on the convertible at the Chinese New Year parade on Saturday.
was my son behaving?
Oh yeah, he was. Yeah, I actually came up to you and say hi, but I'm probably one of the 5,000 other people that shook your hand.
Good to see you.
Anyway,
happy to be here.
Yes. So I actually have two separate questions I'd like to ask you. The first one is having to do with the Board of Education. I know that's a separate agency, not part of San Francisco. It's a different district. I'm sure you're familiar with the whole fiasco with Allison Collins filing a $87 million lawsuit, which was frivolous and thrown out. The Board of Education refuses to try and collect the attorney's fees. Does the city attorney's office have any jurisdiction, any legal authority to try and collect the $125,000 or whatever the attorney's fees are?
So it's a good question. The school district, San Francisco Unified School District, is one of the few public agencies in San Francisco that we are not general counsel to. The school district, the school board reports up to the state level directly. And so unfortunately, we don't have jurisdiction with regards to being able to dictate what happens with the collection of attorney fees there. That being said, you may be aware of the fact that last year, when schools were not reopening, or I should say in the first year of the pandemic when schools were not reopening. My predecessor, Dennis Herrera, brought a lawsuit against the San Francisco Unified School District, which really helped to focus the fact that that more work needed to be done around reopening. And the lawsuit had its impact in nudging the district and the school board to really focus on those issues. This is obviously an ongoing situation, but you know, the quick answer to your question is no, we do not have jurisdiction over that specific issue.
Okay. And then my second question is having to do with all the parklets that are being put out on city streets now. I'm sure you're familiar with them. There are hundreds, if not thousands, out there. It's my understanding that these parklets were put out there as a part of a shared space program, that it is actually a public space and it's open to the public. However, I've noticed quite a few businesses have actually put out signs that say this is a private property, this is reserved for reservation and, you know, for the restaurants and all this and that. I think there's a lot of confusion out there. What can be done about that situation?
So you are correct. You know, shared spaces are supposed to be used for the public. I mean, if there's a particular situation that you have a question about, if there's a particular shared space that has become wholly privatized, you know, it would be interesting. It'd be good for us to know that. There has been pretty significant regulation of shared spaces. And in fact, just a couple months ago, there was a new set of rules that have been proposed as we start to transition from the pandemic back into hopefully a bit more of a normal endemic time. And there are new rules on how shared spaces are supposed to be used. But, you know, to your point, shared spaces were not supposed to be allowing restaurants to simply claim public space for their own purely private purposes.
Okay, so if a business owner insists on asking you to leave the premises, or I've actually witnessed two separate businesses fighting each other over tables and chairs and stuff. So what are the recourse if I'm sitting there at somebody's parklet and I'm having a cup of coffee, I'm reading a newspaper or whatever, or I'm on my laptop and somebody asks me to leave. Should I leave, or is a public space?
It is supposed to be a public space. Now, obviously, restaurateurs have some ability to manage the behavior that's happening in those spaces. But so it's hard to really comment on the specifics of exactly what happened. You strike me as someone who would be a customer at these spaces.
Oh, absolutely. I'm just sitting there, you know, reading a newspaper and you know, I get these guys, the waiters, the waitresses, and they're approaching me like, you know, can I help you? And, you know, this is, you know, we're expecting customers and da, 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 and made me feel very uncomfortable. But I just don't want it to escalate into like having to call the police or something or whatever, you know. So I think perhaps the city attorney needs to, if these are going to be permanent, and I assume they are going to be permanent, then I think business owners, restaurateurs, and the bars need to have an understanding that is that this is shared space and it is open to public groups. And, you know, as long as they're not, you know, creating a disturbance, they are entitled to sit there and use the space. So can perhaps the city attorney can be a little bit more proactive.
So here's what I can tell you. This is a multi-agency set of policies between the Department of Public Works, SFMTA, fire, et cetera. And there is a San Francisco Shared Space Manual that's supposed to govern all this. And if there are issues, I mean, those are the departments that that have the primary enforcement. But obviously, we are supporting that work. And we spend a lot of time working with them on the specific rules, ensuring that the public, you know, to your point, has the public right of way in this space. So I would say, happy to learn more about a specific situation. If there's a particular restaurant that has a practice of kicking members of the public out and not allowing for public access into their space, happy to learn more about that.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, sure thing. And I'm going to ask Britt as well as Michelle for my team if you want to put your email addresses into the chat. So if folks have questions, they can send them to us through the email.
Yeah. Thank you, David. I'll do that right now.
Great. Thanks, Britt.
Great. Nina Moore, did you have a question?
Yes, I did. How do we stay in touch with the city attorney's office to see what's on the scoreboard? You know, won, loss, work in process. I just don't know how to access that. And what would you say your longest ongoing litigation has been? It was something that's been really persistent. I know you're new, and there's probably a lot of skeletons in the closet, but I'm probably just getting at the point of really what do you anticipate or hope your average turnaround time is? Do you even have such a thing?
Sure. So
I was kind of three questions. Sorry.
Okay. So I heard two questions. Well, you want me to answer those two, and then you can ask your last. So the first question is just how do you keep in touch and understand what we're doing? A couple of ways. One, our website, which we are updating constantly. We put out a lot of information to the public through the public information press part of our website, and so you can certainly get information there. In fact, you know, just today, I think we put out two press releases about the Supreme Court argument that we had this morning and what that case was about, as well as we announced, along with the Attorney General and the mayor, that our office had worked as part of a collective mediation between the police department and the district attorney's office on the recent conflicts having to do with allegations of officer involved misconduct. So you can get information there. You can link to me on social media. I push out a lot of information on Twitter, like a lot of folks, but also through Facebook and Instagram. I would say, you know, you should certainly look to Britt on this call if you have code issues, if there are issues in your neighborhood that you want to bring to our attention, or more general issues you can also bring to the attention of Michelle Kong, who is sitting on this call as well. So that's question number one. Question number two was about longstanding lawsuits. I will tell you, lawsuits often do not get resolved overnight, as you likely know. We have lawsuits that have been stemming for many years. I was recently apprised of the fact that there's been litigation around bike lanes in the city for over a decade. That has been ongoing. Oftentimes, issues around CEQA last a long time. So it's kind of hard to quickly answer that question, but suffice it to say is we have an awful lot of lawsuits that we are managing at any time. As I mentioned to you, 4,000 claims brought against our city every year. We are trying to resolve as many of those as we can, but when we don't think that we ought to, and when we are defending to the hilt, suits brought against the city, these suits can take longer. So there's not kind of a quick and easy way to answer that question. I mentioned the Trump litigation, the fact that we are still litigating some of the anti-immigrant policies that Trump proposed that are no longer even on the books, right? This stuff takes some time. And your third question?
No, I think we wrapped them all up in those two.
Okay, great.
Okay, Robert Chan, you have a question.
Yes, hi, David.
Hey, Robert, how are you?
Good, good. I have a question about you, for you, about the role of the city attorney's office in handling public records requests. I have some friends who are journalists, and they've struggled in recent times with getting information from certain departments of the city. Uh-huh. And, I've reviewed some of the responses that they've gotten. It feels like they're being stonewalled. Uh-huh. And I worked with one nonprofit, Stop Crime SF, and they went as far as to hire an attorney to help them with their public records requests. And then someone from your office appeared on behalf of the responding agency. So I was curious, what exactly is the role of your office when these things come up?
Yeah, so a significant part of our role is to educate all of the 100 plus boards and commissions and agencies on what their obligations are under public records law and sunshine laws. So every department is required to publicly disclose information that's requested of it within a timely period of time. And there are rules around how much time that's supposed to be and record retention. And what we do on a regular basis is we are educating all agencies on what the rules are, and those agencies are supposed to be following those rules. Now, as you can imagine, given the volume of information, we can't police every single department on what is or is not happening. But when it is brought to our attention, particularly if there are violations, at that point, that is something that we can step in and have more of a conversation around. So our job, we literally cannot police the millions of documents, that all these agencies have. But if there are certain issues that you want to bring to our attention, if there's a pattern on the part of a particular department or agency that seems to be stonewalling, happy to learn more about that. And if we think that that they're crossing lines, we can certainly have more of a discussion with those departments.
Okay. Who gets the final say? You know, if they are stubborn and refuse to cooperate with your advice or choose to ignore your advice, is there any way that you could make them comply, or are you stuck defending their position?
So the Sunshine Ordinance Task Force is, they have the ability to review situations of violations of these rules. And from time to time, if there is a party that sues the city, it is our job and it's our obligation to defend against that lawsuit. Now, listen, I will say that I believe that, as Justice Louis Brandeis once said, that sunshine is the best disinfectant, and it's important for there to be public transparency to keep the public's confidence in what government is doing. I certainly, and my deputies, we all are advising our clients to abide by the laws that exist when it comes to public records and sunshine. So this is, you know, certainly the perspective of our office, but, you know, from time to time, there are matters that rise, to the level of litigation. And, in those instances, you know, we defend those, agencies, but I will tell you, you know, certainly we also, our office, we tell our clients, we cannot defend you if you're violating the law. And by that, I mean, you know, we will lose in court. So this is how we are also pushing our clients to come into compliance.
Thank you. I was also curious. You mentioned the Sunshine Ordinance. A friend of mine actually went all the way with his matter through the Sunshine Ordinance Task Force. And the task force came out with a finding that the agency violated their obligations. But unfortunately, the task force seems to have no teeth. They don't have enforcement power. Is that right? Or is there something that he can do further after the Sunshine Task Force concludes that you know, he's in the right and the agency is in the wrong?
So it's hard for me to comment on exactly what the situation was. Do you know which agency was involved?
The DA's office.
Ah, gotcha. As you can imagine, particularly when you're dealing with law enforcement, there are all sorts of privacy issues that come up with regards to records. So I suspect, again, it's hard for me to comment on anything in the abstract, but I suspect that the district attorney's office, like the police department, like other law enforcement agencies, may be invoking certain privileges around confidential investigations. So again, hard to really comment on that without knowing the specifics.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure thing.
Great. Do we have other calls? Otherwise, I have. Jack Berry, go ahead. Jack, you're muted.
Sorry, my damn computer's a pain. Sorry about that. So I'm confused about what happens when a citizen goes to you because they think that some city worker is doing something illegal. You know, who knows, taking a bribe or taking a box of oranges, whatever the heck it is. Do you look into that for them? Because you're also in the role of representing the city workers, I guess. So it might be hard for you to be also acting on the citizens' part. Do you refer these angry citizens over to some other city department to look into it? How does that work?
So it's a good question. As you can imagine, particularly if there are any allegations of corruption, misuse of funds, et cetera, we have investigators who will investigate all of those potential issues alongside the city controller through their whistleblower program. So I have an entire unit of investigators that's headed up by a former federal prosecutor whose job it is to look into allegations of corruption. And as I mentioned before, the work that this unit has done in the last couple of years is what led to all the issues with DBI and the departure of the head of DBI, issues involving the departure of the head of the Public Utilities Commission, the former city administrator, et cetera. So this is work that we take deadly seriously. The corruption investigations are ongoing. I can't talk about specifics around those investigations for obvious reasons, but this is, you know, if there is a worker who has been involved in corruption, that is not a situation where we have to defend that worker. Our duty is to ensure that we are investigating that corruption.
Thank you. Got it.
That's good to know. Do we have other questions? I'm not seeing them. Feel free to jump in if I've missed you. So I'm going to ask a question. David, when you went through your board at the top, sharing your screen, you briefly touched on the fact that you can do investigations and take action on drug sales and manufacture, but not use. In light of that, I seem to recall your predecessor did something with regard to the Tenderloin. What are your plans to stop the open air drug markets in the Tenderloin?
Yeah.
I should add, and I'll try to make this very short. To my knowledge, the district attorney in the last 2 years has not been able to prosecute a single drug sales case and send anybody to prison for a day even. The feds have prosecuted them, and I think they've been successfully at least once. But what are your plans? What are your thoughts about this?
So let me answer the question as follows. The district attorney's office has purview over the enforcement of criminal laws. And what that typically means is if there's an individual who is engaging in criminal activity, that is within the purview of the police department to arrest and then the district attorney's office to enforce. Our office is involved when there are property owners who on whose properties there are laws that are being violated. We have some ability to hold those property owners accountable in the civil context, but not in the criminal context. So that's a major distinction. But Frank, what you were referring to, there was a case that was started by Dennis Herrera that was patterned after gang injunctions that then City Attorney Herrera pursued about a decade ago. And the theory of the more recent case was that we have out-of-town drug dealers, many of whom are coming from the East Bay, who then take BART or otherwise drive into the Tenderloin and are violating criminal laws in our city. And Dennis Herrera, he asked a judge to basically keep these drug dealers outside, like essentially keep them away from the Tenderloin so that they could not conduct their criminal enterprise in the Tenderloin. That case is ongoing. I am very supportive of it. And in fact, just last week, we had actually lost the first major argument at the trial court level. We appealed that up to the Court of Appeals, and under my tenure, we argued that case in the First District Court of Appeal just last week. So we will see what happens to it. But from my perspective, as I've said, we need to do everything we can to address the level of crime that is happening in the Tenderloin. We need to use all the tools at our city's disposal obviously the district attorney has a number of tools, but if we are able to enforce a civil injunction to keep known drug dealers out of the Tenderloin, I will ensure that we do that.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do we have other questions? Feel free to speak up.
I'll just ask quickly. It's the lawsuits with Recology have been very visible lately. What's the final status of that?
So my predecessor was able to get a $100 million settlement against Recology for wrongdoing over the years. In the last couple of months, there have been some additional allegations of potentially more money that Recology may owe the city. And so at this time, there is a continued investigation being led by the controller, Ben Rosenfield, into that. We are expecting conclusions in that in the near future. And obviously, if there is additional legal work that needs to be done, we will certainly be engaged. But, you know, clearly Recology in many, many instances crossed a whole number of lines and was held accountable. And if we need to continue to hold them accountable, we will do so. I will also mention that there is a ballot measure that is proceeding through the Board of Supervisors, spearheaded by Supervisor Peskin. Our office has been involved in helping to draft it. I know that the mayor's office and the Board of Supervisors are working together in basically changing the rate making process for how Recology's rates are set. Because clearly there were major issues in how it was done before, which led to a number of instances of corruption that we uncovered. So that will very likely be in front of the voters shortly. So that's another part of the Recology conversation.
Okay. Again, anyone feel free to jump in. Otherwise, I'm going to ask a question.
I have just one.
I do realize. Yes, please. Go ahead.
David, I just have one quick question. So does the city and county of San Francisco have an agency where they have checks and balances on all the city departments? For example, there's been corruption going on in San Francisco city department for going back decades. And I find it kind of peculiar that it took an FBI and Justice Department investigation to come in to find all these corruption. Why is the city attorney, district attorney, San Francisco police and local authorities not aware of, you know, of things that are happening basically right next to them, right in front of them?
So I will tell you, in, I think it was 2013, I was the president of the Board of Supervisors and had a number of conversations with then City Attorney Dennis Herrera. The two of us had the sense that there were some funny things that were going on in city business. We had questions about permit expediters at the Department of Building Inspection. We wondered about the influence of certain developers. And at the time, the two of us proposed a major package of ethics reform bills. While a version of our initial legislation passed, the full set of reforms that we wanted were not included in the final version. And I would say, you know, to your point, I've heard of bits and pieces of things over the years, but it really wasn't until the last couple of years when under my predecessor, Dennis Herrera, and our colleague in the city attorney's office, who's a former federal prosecutor, managing a team of investigators, they were able to uncover significant wrongdoings, significant misuse of public resources within the Department of Public Works under Mohamed Nuru, within the Public Utilities Commission under Harlan Kelly, certainly within the Department of Building Inspection. As I think folks know, the former director, Tom Huey, stepped down after information about our investigation became public. Now, because we are the city attorney, we can't bring criminal cases. And so we turned over a lot of the evidence from those civil investigations over to the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office, who then eventually brought the criminal cases against a number of individuals that I've just named. And so I would say what's happened in the last couple of years, very much driven by the work of our office in conjunction with criminal law enforcement authorities. Now, let me also say, if any of you have any additional information or evidence about potential corruption, please let us know. Because from my perspective, we need to hold city government to the highest ethical standards. We need to follow every lead of potential corruption, and we need to follow the facts where they lead.
Robert, did you still have a question?
Yes, hold on. David, almost everyone that I've spoken to regarding the budget for the homeless, you know, is alarmed by how much money our city spends. And everyone has complained about the lack of accountability, performance standards, transparency. I mean, where is all this money going? And, you know, who's creating these contracts? You guys have some review of contracts that you guys do, but who actually oversees how these contracts are handed out, what the terms are, whether there's any performance standards involved? It seems like it's something that we have to get a hold of, because we're moving from a period of great prosperity in our city to one of, you know, much harder times. And we're not going to have that much money to spend, and we have to spend our money a lot more carefully. So, you know, do you have a plan to make sure that these contracts, you know, we get bang for the buck?
So it's a great question. And let me say this, which is, during many of my 7 years in the state legislature, I literally said what Robert did, which is our city has spent a historic amount of money trying to grapple with homelessness on our streets. And yet we have very little to show on it. 20 years ago, we were spending $100 million a year on homelessness, and we had 7,000 homeless individuals on our streets. Fast forward 20 years later, we are now spending 3, 4, 5 times that, and yet we still have the same number of folks homeless on our streets. So, I do think that government needs to do a better job of being held accountable to metrics. Contracts need to be reviewed. When I was in the legislature, and obviously I just left the legislature a couple months ago, I had pushed a number of state laws to really hold cities accountable in this regard. And in fact, some of my laws are embedded now in state law, such that if a city like San Francisco wants state funding, they need to show the metrics that they're using money well. So totally agree with you on the point of accountability. We need to do a better job about that. Now, that being said, let me shift to say the challenges around homelessness have intensified in a number of ways. One, we are all aware of the opioid crisis on our streets, drug addictions, and how incredibly challenging that has been for grappling with homelessness. Secondly, we do have the worst housing crisis in our state and frankly national history. And the fact of the matter is we just do not have enough housing to put everyone who needs housing under a roof. Third, and this is more of a macroeconomic issue, we have the most intense income inequality that our city, our state, our world has seen. And what that means is, you know, unless you have a certain level of income, you are probably one paycheck, one retirement check, one rent check away from an eviction. And so that's hugely challenging. I'll give an example of that. The statistic in Los Angeles is for every 133 homeless folks that are housed every day, 150 people become homeless. So just think about it. They're able to successfully put over 100 folks in a roof, and every day over 150 people need a roof. In Oakland, in recent years, that statistic has been one person housed for every two people who become homeless. In San Francisco, that statistic is the same, if not worse. So we're grappling with this. And, you know, to your point, I completely appreciate that it feels like there's sort of no end to this. But we know that, you know, addressing any complicated situation on our streets requires housing solutions, requires mental health solutions, requires the criminal justice system to be involved, requires the public health system to be involved. And that's all expensive. But, you know, to get to what you're saying, at the end of the day, government needs to figure out for every dollar we spend, for every $1 million we spend, for every $1 billion we spend, are we getting the best bang for our buck? How do we ensure that we're getting our money's worth?
Okay. I have a question, and unless there's somebody else who has one, we're going to wrap up with that. I see Jack does. Go ahead, Jack.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Well, Wesley's up here, so Wesley, you can go, I guess. Sure.
Thank you, Jack. David, I have a quick question back to homelessness. As we are aware of NIMBYism, and I guess Scott Wiener had passed the law of SB9, does the city of San Francisco has the authority to sue other cities if they refuse to build housing for affordable housing units?
It's a great question. So historically, cities have not sued other cities. The state can sue cities for not doing more, but typically you don't see neighboring cities suing other neighboring cities, in part because, for example, we know that there are cities around the Bay, let's say Silicon Valley, that are not building their fair share of housing. The challenge is if we were to bring a suit, they could probably sue us for also not building housing. So I'm not sure how judges would deal with that. And so traditionally that hasn't happened. But as you may know, the state of California under the Attorney General has recently sent some very strong public signals that if San Francisco doesn't do a better job of building more housing, that we might, that there's going to be more scrutiny, potentially some laws that they're looking at that they wonder if we are in compliance with. And this is true not just for San Francisco, but for many cities around the Bay.
So that includes like suburban cities like Burlingame, San Mateo, Sausalito, San Rafael, yep. Palo Alto. Okay.
You may have heard, you know, recently it was the city of Woodside,
an animal sanctuary or something like that.
Basically said that that because mountain lions. Now I have to,
mountain lion. Yeah. Some sort of animal.
Because mountain lions, spend time in Woodside that they couldn't turn single family zone neighborhoods into say duplex or fourplex zone neighborhoods. And, the Attorney General sent a very sternly worded letter to Woodside telling them to essentially cease and desist. And over the course of a weekend, Woodside, miraculously, change their perspective on that issue.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's what, you know, I mean, this homeless issue has been going on for 40 years. And unless the suburban cities, you know, become part of the solution rather than part of the problem, it's not going to go away anytime soon. It's, you know, it's that simple. Every city needs to address the issue. And so it's not just a San Francisco problem or Los Angeles problem. Every single city should be doing their fair share.
I could not agree with you more. And, you know, I got to tell you, I wish I have given so Michelle, who's on this call, who's been with me from when I was a state legislator. She could tell you I've given many speeches over the years about the responsibility that every jurisdiction has to build. People can throw some rocks at San Francisco for not doing everything we need to, but you can also go around the Bay and most cities are not meeting their targets, which we're going to need to, if we're going to build our way out of this crisis. I think some of you may know, there's this thing called RENA. RENA stands for the Regional Housing Needs Allocation, which are essentially, every couple of years, the state puts targets on every region in California on how many units of housing need to be developed in different areas. And many jurisdictions are woefully below that. And in the Bay, many of our jurisdictions are not meeting those RENA targets. And when I was in the state legislature, a lot of my focus was trying to figure out how to juice housing production at all levels of production in every part of the state at all levels of affordability, because everyone has fallen down. And you're right. You know, we have a lot of neighbors to our south, to our north, to the east of us who are not doing their part. But then at the same time, they then will criticize us for not doing our part. Everyone needs to do their part. I actually, one of the housing policies I enacted that I'm most proud of is moving forward this concept of a Bay Area, the Bay Area as a region, a region that needs to focus on housing collectively. We have 9 counties. We have 101 cities. And so often individual cities, individual counties have not been able to move forward a housing agenda. And what I've suggested is we've got to come at this collectively, not think of ourselves as the city of Woodside or the city of Brisbane or the city of San Francisco. We've got to think of ourselves as a region, with a regional housing shortage, a regional homelessness crisis, and regional needs. We've got to think about what smart growth looks like. How do we integrate jobs and transit and housing, and do this in a better way? But I probably digress.
Thank you, Dave.
Well, thank you very much for your strong advocacy on housing issues. We greatly appreciate it. Jack, you get the last question. Thank
Great.
You.
So I have people that I've heard of who have stuck that they were afraid to report to anybody at City Hall because it's about criminal stuff by other city workers. So is there a place that a person could drop off anonymously stuff like that without fearing their house being torched?
Yeah, absolutely. Michelle, do you want to throw up the PowerPoint and maybe put the last slide up with the controller's whistleblower program information?
So it's go to the whistleblower, okay.
And we investigate, along with the controller's office, complaints that are brought to our attention.
Got it, okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let's see, I think, so it's https://sfcontroller.org/whistleblower-program. Or just Google controller's whistleblower program.
Thanks.
David, when a complaint is made through that whistleblower program, is there an acknowledgement from your office? Is there, or does it just go into some black hole and you never hear back from the office about the status of the complaint? Is there some kind of ongoing communication?
You know, I would be surprised. This is a program run out of the controller's office. I would be surprised if there's not specific follow-up by the control at least once to whoever the complainant is on a particular allegation. So I don't know for sure, but I'd be very surprised if there was not there's not follow-up.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I'm going to reserve the last question for myself here, and that is, and I realize you do not have criminal law responsibilities, but you've been involved in San Francisco government and state government for a long time. And I would ask you to use your bully pulpit. There's a case where Ed French, who lives in our general neighborhood, was murdered. He was 73 years old. He was at the west of Twin Peaks lookout, and he was murdered, in 4 years ago. And, there has not been a trial on this yet. It keeps getting delayed and delayed. But what is it that we can do? What can you do to make this happen? Justice delayed is justice denied. His sister and his brother and his family and her friends are just outraged.
So first of all, what happened to Ed French? Obviously horrific. Tragic, and my deepest sympathies to those of you who knew him. As you said, this is a case that is squarely within our law enforcement system. It is certainly not part of the purview of what our office is about. I can tell you, as a former prosecutor, I think it's important for your association and those of you who care about this to be continuing to ask questions of the police department and the district attorney's office. This is law and order. This is how our system is supposed to work. And you should invite leadership from both of those offices to join your association and to ask them questions about individual cases that I obviously am not privy to. But I think that's entirely appropriate and something you should consider.
Okay. Thank you for joining us here tonight. We greatly appreciate it. And we will be seeing you around town.
Of course.
Thank you everyone for having me. From Sharp and everyone who's been here. Thank you.
It's good to see everyone, and be safe. Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you.
Bye now.